Empty Set Entertainment presents A Light, Book 2 in the Generations Trilogy. Written by Scott Sigler. Read by Emma Galvin.
1. A stabbing pain jolts me awake. I open my eyes to darkness, total darkness. My head feels thick, my thoughts clogged. The pain is where my neck meets my shoulder, but it's already fading. I remember a sting just like it, but much worse. That day. Was it my birthday? Yes, I think so. My 12th birthday. A chill floods me. This has happened before. I am in a coffin. A monster is coming for me. A rot black thing with one ravaged eye. Matilda. No, that's not quite right. It's different this time. I can move my hands. Last time they were held down. My fingers rise up through the darkness. I feel a lid, so close it's almost touching my face and chest. I need to escape before the monster destroys me. I need a weapon. The spear. Where is my spear? I punch at the lid. I scream and I hammer at it with fists and knees. A noise. A whir of machinery. I feel the coffin lid start to slide down toward my feet. Light hits me, burning my eyes even through tightly scrunched lids. I can't see. I lash out wildly, blindly, punching and clawing. Hands grab my wrists. Em, it's okay. A girl's voice. I recognize it. Spingate. Calm down, she says. Everything is fine. Her hand takes mine. Our fingers clasp tightly. Her skin is warm and soft, her grip strong and confident. We've landed, she says. You're safe. Safe. That word is an illusion. And yet I feel my body relax a little. I recall something big and silver, something that gave me hope. But the image evades me. Landed? What are you talking about? Her other hand strokes my hair. It comforts me, takes away some of my fear. You're still groggy from the gas in your coffin, she says. The effect should wear off pretty fast. Even as she says this, I feel my head clearing. The fog drifts away. Memories rush back. Horrible memories. Waking up in a coffin. The needle driving into my neck. Fighting my way out. Not knowing who or where I was. My entire past gone. Save for a few wisps of someone else's life. Saving Spingate, then O'Malley, then Bello, Aramovsky, and Yong. The hideous cracked skull of a little boy, skin dried tight to his bones, clothes too big for his small body. The skeletons, the dust, the endless dungeon hallways, our long walk, my knife sliding into Yong's belly. Finding Bishop, Gaston, Latu, and the rest. The vote, where I became leader. Two tribes merging into one. The pigs. Latu's death. The garden. That's where I last felt safe, when I still believed that childish concept existed. Bello's terror-wide eyes, when the monster's wrinkled black hands dragged her into the garden's underbrush. Those monsters, the grown-ups. With their red eyes and spindly limbs, their gnarled skin, fleshy folds hanging where their mouths should have been. Bello. The shame of that moment hammers me. I left her. For the greater good, my head tells me, but my heart calls me a coward. Meeting Brewer. Discovering that we weren't underground, that we were on an ancient spaceship called the Zolotl. The grown-ups were creatures that should have died centuries ago. They wanted to wipe our minds clean and take over our young bodies as easily as someone might change their clothes. Learning about Omeokan, the planet we were made for. Then, my decision to attack. Harris, dying somewhere in the garden. Capturing Matilda, finding the big silver shuttle. And when we were almost away, Elsa Fani. The boy and girl twins who finished each other's sentences, charged an army of withered walking corpses, and were blown to pieces. We escaped the Zolotl, but at such a price. Let's stand you up, Spingate says. She helps me rise and step out. My legs immediately buckle. Spingate holds me, keeps me from falling. I think of an almost identical moment, when I was the one comforting her, telling her to be calm, helping her out of a coffin. My eyes don't sting as much. I blink them open and see the face of my friend. Spingate's curly red hair is a tangled mess. Her green eyes are sunken, ringed by skin so dark it looks bruised. I've never seen her this pale. The black circular gear symbol on her forehead stands out in stark contrast. I think I can stand on my own now. Spingate kisses me on the cheek, lets me go. We're in a long, narrow room. Red walls and ceiling, gleaming black floor. Two rows of thin white coffins lined up side by side run the length of the room. Wide aisles run along each wall, as well as one down the middle that leads through a curved opening. Just past that opening, and to the right is the door we use to enter the shuttle. Past that door, the strange room of light, where Gaston and Spingate glowed like angels. These coffins are simple and plain, designed just to let people sleep, I think. They aren't like the big carved coffins that tended to us while we grew from babies into the bodies we have now. My coffin is open. The lid rolled down somewhere into the foot of the thing. The other coffins remain sealed tight. The one to the right of mine holds O'Malley. The one to the left, Bishop. I held their hands until the lids closed. A boy walks through the curved opening, shuffles down the middle aisle toward us. It's Gaston. He's holding my spear. He's still wearing his red tie, which is embroidered with a yellow and black circle of tiny images, the word Mictlan, in white letters at its center. His white shirt is mostly clean, mostly untorn. I glance at my own too small shirt, ripped in a dozen places and splattered with blood. My shredded plaid skirt barely covers me. Gaston offers me the spear. I take it. Then he clutches me in a hard hug. Em, we did it. I return the hug. It feels so good to hold him. You did it, I say. You flew us to Omeokan. He steps back. His smile, part charm, part arrogance, is as wide as ever. Gaston is impressed with himself. Despite his joy, it's clear he has also had no rest. His black hair hangs down his face, partially hiding his eyes. It was amazing, he says. Once the pilot house lights hit me, I remembered my creator's training from when he was little. Some of my blanked out areas seemed to clear. I don't know how that's possible. I have blanked out areas too. We all do. When our brains search for memories we know should be there, they usually return only whispers and echoes. We were never meant to know anything for ourselves. We were receptacles, shells, created to house another person. If he can remember how to fly, maybe our blank areas aren't permanently blank, like Matilda told me they were. Gaston and Spingate look exhausted. I'm sore and scratched, bruised and beaten, but I don't feel tired at all. How long did I sleep? Only the 2 hours it took us to land, Spingate says. The shuttle told us the coffin gas does something to our brains, lets you sleep far deeper than you could on your own. We can take it in the pilot house, too. You'd still be sleeping if I hadn't told the shuttle to give you the wake-up injection. That sting in my neck. Not a knife. Not a snake. Not a bite. Just a needle. I think about Brewer, how he tried to use a coffin needle to murder me. Then I push that thought away. We don't need to worry about him anymore. We're home. What's it like outside? Gaston's little hand reaches over to Spingate's. Their fingers lock. We don't know, he says. It was dark when we landed. The shuttle had a pre-programmed landing pad that took us down a big circular hole of some kind. Maybe to protect us from wind, I'm not sure. It was nighttime when we flew in, and there was heavy cloud cover. He says cloud cover like he's proud of the words, like it was an obstacle that not just anyone could overcome. So, you haven't been outside at all? Spingate shakes her head. You deserve to be the first. They waited for me, out of respect. I don't know what to say. I'll go with you, she says. The shuttle says the air is safe for us. For us, but not for the grown-ups who made us. We were designed to be able to survive down here, and in that lies our safety. Even if the grown-ups could reach Omeokan, which they can't, because this was the last shuttle, this planet's very air would kill them. Spingate holds up her left arm. Her forearm is wrapped in a sheet of gold, intricately carved and studded with black jewels. It reminds me of the bracelets the grown-ups used to kill Elsa Fani, but somehow, I know it's not a weapon. Gaston found this in storage, she says. It's called a bracer. I can use it to scan for things that could hurt us, things like microorganisms or toxins. She speaks those words the same way Gaston said cloud cover. New, important words that she is proud of knowing. There's no reason to wait any longer. We have nowhere else to go. The birthday children will survive on Omeokan, or the birthday children will die here. My stomach lets out a loud growl. An instant later, I wince at the pain. I'm so hungry it hurts. We have food, Gaston says. The deck below has storerooms full of tools, clothes, and lots of food. What's a deck? A floor, Spingate answers. Except on a ship, it's called a deck. It never occurred to me this shuttle had more floors. Show me, I say. We walk to the rear of the coffin room. The back wall is red like the side walls. Up close, I see the thin, almost invisible outline of a door. In that door is the faint shape of a handprint with a gear symbol in the palm. Gaston presses his hand to the print. The door silently swings inward, revealing a metal staircase spiraling down. We descend. 10 stairs below is another door. The handprint here is also a gear. Spingate leads us in. The corridor looks long, perhaps as long as the shuttle itself. There are doors on my left marked Storage 1 through Storage 6, and on my right labeled Lab 1 through Lab 3. At the end of the corridor is a door marked Medical. The storage rooms have handprints with gears and half circles. The labs, only gears. Medical's handprint is a circle cross. We didn't have time to look at the labs, Gaston says. Just the... An eye-scrunching yawn pauses his words. Just the storage rooms. The first storage room holds floor-to-ceiling racks of black bins. Gaston opens one. Black coveralls made from heavy cloth. I think back to the Zolotl, to the hundreds of mutilated, tortured bodies dressed in similar outfits. It would be nice to change out of my torn rags, but the black clothes are some uniform of the grown-ups, and right now I don't want to think about the grown-ups. 4 rooms hold racks of green bins. Gaston opens one of the bins. It's full of small white packages with black letters that spell out grain bar. A second bin's packages are labeled crackers. All the bins are full, Gaston says. There's enough food to last us, all of us, for about 30 days. Isn't that great? He thinks 30 days is a long time. It will go by very quickly. The final room holds neat racks of tools. One of Matilda's memories rushes up, where she first saw pigs. These are the kind of tools people use on a farm. Other racks hold bins filled with smaller tools, the kind used to fix things, to make things. I see another bracer, like the one Spingate is wearing. I'm sure there will be a need for all of these tools, but until we know what awaits us outside the shuttle, there is something we need even more. What about weapons? Spingate shakes her head. No bracelets, nothing. Damn. As soon as you get some rest, learn about the labs, I say to her. Are there more floors? I mean decks? 2 more, Spingate says. But they have half-circle handprints on the doors. They won't open for us. A half-circle, the symbol on O'Malley's forehead. We ask the shuttle what's down there, Gaston says. It says it doesn't know. I can tell it bothers him greatly that he can't access those decks. I heard the shuttle call him Captain Xander. How can there be parts of the shuttle that won't open for him? We can worry about that later. I'm consumed by my need to get outside. See Omeokan. Spingate, wake up the circle stars. End O'Malley. She nods. Right away. Anybody else? Smith, I say. Tell her to learn all she can about that medical room. Smith seems to know how to treat cuts and scrapes. I think it has something to do with her forehead mark, a circle cross. She's the only one our age with that symbol. Two of the younger kids have it, though. So maybe soon Smith will have help healing our sick and wounded. Gaston and Spingate look like they might pass out at any moment. I will make sure they rest, just not right now. I know you're both tired, but I need you a little while longer before you can sleep. Whatever it takes, Gaston says instantly. Spingate simply smiles at me, as if to say, I will always help you, no matter what. I've only been alive for a few days, yet I love these two so much it hurts. Spingate and Gaston, my friends. Spin, you'll come with me outside. Gaston, while we're gone, wake up everyone else and also prepare a meal. We should all eat together. I lift the spear slightly, let it fall back to the hard floor with a soft clomp. It's time to see our new home. 2. We gather just inside the shuttle's main door. My circle stars, Bishop, Farrar, Visca, Coyotl, and Bawden. They wear nothing but filthy cut-off pants. On the Zolotl, they covered themselves in a paste that made them all the same color, gray. Now that material is flaking away, showing the different skin tones beneath. We don't have bracelets like the ones grown-ups used to kill El Safani, but the rack of farming supplies means we are not completely unarmed. In our hands, tools have once again become weapons. Maybe you should stay here, Em, Bishop says. You could help O'Malley explore the rest of the ship. He holds a red axe he took from the storage room. I think about him swinging it as hard as he can, powerful muscles driving the sharp blade into a living thing, and I have to suppress a shiver. I'm going, I say, adjusting my grip on my spear. I need to know what's out there. He wants to protect me. His concern makes me feel warm inside, but I will not sit back while my people face danger. The flesh around his left eye is swollen and bruised. When he put me in the coffin, trying to save my life, I went crazy and punched him. I feel horrible about that. Such seriousness in his face. I want to reach out and touch his blonde curls, but now is not the time. When I first met him, he smiled easily, seemed so happy and confident. Not anymore. He killed two grown-ups. Taking those lives changed him. I hope he can find his smile again, but if he feels inside the same way I do, I doubt it. At the back of the coffin room, I see the door in the red wall open. O'Malley and Spingate step out, walk down the center aisle to join us. He's holding the knife I used to kill Yong. Somehow, that weapon became his. I'll take a good look around the shuttle while you go outside, he says. But are you sure I shouldn't come with you? Does he want to see the planet, or does he also want to protect me? It doesn't matter. We need to learn all we can as fast as we can. Besides, he's made for thinking, not fighting. I'll be fine. I have Bishop with me. O'Malley looks down, and I cringe inside. I meant to say, I have the circle stars with me, but that's not what came out. If he's hurt, he recovers quickly, grins at me. Just be smart, he says. We have all the time this world has to offer. Don't rush anything. Our ordeal has affected him too, but not like it has Bishop. O'Malley's blue eyes are vibrant, filled with excitement for our new adventure. Brittle bits of leaves cling to his brown hair, dried blood stains his ill-fitting white shirt, especially at the collar below the nasty cut on his left cheek. He suffered that wound in the garden, during our fight with the grown-ups. I wonder what he had to do back there. I wonder if he, like Bishop and I, now know how it feels to kill. O'Malley looks at Bishop, then offers the knife, hilt first. Take it, O'Malley says. If I'm staying here, you need it more than I do. Back on the Zolotl, the two boys came close to killing each other. Will they get along better now that we're on Omeokan? Bishop lifts his axe slightly. I like this better, he says. The two boys have been alive for only a few days, yet they are both already marked with wounds that will become scars. In that, they aren't alone. My fingertips touch my split upper lip, the bump on my forehead, trace my cuts and scratches and bruises. We earn these badges of bravery. Our creators designed our bodies. Our faces are theirs. These scars are the only things we can truly call our own. Bishop isn't the only one with a new weapon. White-haired, pink-skinned Visca holds a sledgehammer that is almost as tall as Gaston. Farrar chose a long-handled shovel. He is the largest of us, save only for Bishop, and I bet the point, or edge, of the thick shovel blade could do horrible damage to flesh and blood. Baudin has an axe just like Bishop's. I find myself wondering how long it takes hair to grow. The first hints are showing on her shaved head, dark brown skin giving way to stubble. With most of her dust gone, there is no ignoring the fact that she wears nothing but a tattered skirt. Her nakedness makes me want to look away. She doesn't seem to notice it. Coyote made the strangest choice of all. He still holds the thigh bone he used against the grown-ups. His skin has a bright hue, as if he spent far too long in the sun. I meet Spingate's gaze. Her eyebrows rise in a silent question. It is time. Open it, I say. The shuttle doors slide apart. The morning sun is a blinding, reddish ball creeping above the high tree line. I lift a hand to block out the light, feel the sun's heat against my skin. A breeze caresses us, carrying new scents. My head spins as Matilda's fractured memories rush to the surface, try to put names on what I smell. Damp wood, burned grass, and something like mint. I step onto the shuttle's platform. I don't know where the platform goes when we fly, but it is exactly as it was on the Zolotl. A metal rectangle big enough to hold us all. A ramp leads down to flat ground, covered in dark blue vines with wide, pale yellow leaves. Some of the leaves and vines are burned black. Maybe our shuttle did that when it landed. We're in the center of what looks like a large round clearing. A dense wall of leaves, the same pale yellow as the vines that cover the ground, towers up from the clearing's curved edge. The sky is a circular patch high above us. I understand why Gaston thought we flew into a hole. Bishop walks slowly down the ramp, both hands on his axe. Muscles twitch and flex. He scowls at the trees, at the vines covering the clearing, maybe at the sun itself. He wants this world to know he is ready to fight. He stops at the ramp's end, reaches one bare foot toward the vines. Wait, I say. Spingate, come with me. The reddish sun seems to ignite the air around her hair. If anyone was made for this place, it is Teresa Spingate. We walk down the ramp and join Bishop. I point down at the vines. Do you think those plants are safe to step on? Spingate kneels at the ramp's edge. Fingers outstretched, she waves her bracer-adorned arm over the leaves. The black jewels come alive, sparkle in many colors. The shuttle doesn't detect any known poisons, she says. None that can go through the skin anyway. Just don't eat anything. I glance back at the big silver ship that brought us here, then at her. The shuttle told you that? She turns her head and pulls back her hair, shows a small black jewel nestled in her ear. It can speak to me through this. So can Gaston. I again look down at the vines. This is it. Our moment. I consider letting Bishop go first, or even Spingate, giving one of them the honor of being the first person to set foot on our new world. But I want that honor for myself. I am the leader, and it is my right. I step off the ramp. The leaves are soft and cool under my bare feet, except for the ones that were blackened during the landing. Those crunch and break. There is something firm beneath the leaves. I turn my spear upside down. Dried red gray, Matilda's blood, coats the blade's flat metal. I need to clean that up soon. I want to leave all memories of her behind. I push the spear tip into the plants. It sinks in a little, then clonks against something hard. Bishop, come help. He kneels beside me. His big hands rip at the blue vines and yellow leaves. That minty smell grows stronger. He clears the plants from a small area, leaving only crumbly brown dirt. He wipes that away as well, revealing flat metal. I walk to a new spot, push the spear tip into the vines. Clonk. I move to my right, do it again. Hear the same sound. The tree line. Those leaves go straight up. A sheer curved wall of pale yellow surrounding a perfectly circular clearing. That can't be right, can it? Bishop stands. Farrar, Coyotl, come with me. The three boys jog toward the wall of trees. I turn back to Spingate. We're standing on metal, I say. What is this place? Wide-eyed, she blinks. I don't know. The shuttle told us where to land, so we landed. I'll see what Gaston can find out. Her lips move, but I can't hear what she says. She cocks her head, hearing a voice meant only for her. She's so exhausted she didn't think to ask about where we landed. Until this moment, neither did I. We were all so focused on escaping the Xolotl, we didn't give much thought to what awaited us on Omeokan. Spingate nods. Gaston says the shuttle doesn't know much, but this isn't a clearing. It's a landing pad. So Omeokan isn't an unexplored wilderness after all. Did the grown-ups build this? If so, when? And are those builders still here? This planet is ours, but that doesn't mean we won't have to take it away from someone else. Em! Bishop is shouting at me from the tree line. Coyotl and Farrar are leaning to the left and right, respectively, pulling apart the yellow trees. Only they aren't trees at all. They are vines, the same kind I'm standing on, and in the shadows behind them, a metal wall. Spingate tugs on my sleeve. Gaston says he figured out how to make the landing pad rise up. It takes me a moment to process what she just said. I start to tell her no, but before the words come out, a violent tremor knocks me off balance, throws me down on the vines. Spingate falls to her hands and knees. The ground beneath me lurches upward, then stops so suddenly it tosses me into the air. I crash back down onto the soft plants. Another vibration shakes my bones. Then we rise up, fast. Screams of metal hurt my ears. Spingate! Tell Gaston to make it stop! Another shudder knocks her flat, but she isn't afraid. Her eyes are wide with wonder. She's laughing. Gaston says it's okay. Just hold on. The ground presses into me. We're moving faster now. At the edges of the clearing, the vines seem to pour down the sides, bunching up at the bottom like falling rope. But the vines aren't falling. Instead, the ground is coming up beneath them. Bishop, Coyotl, and Farrar are still on their feet, lively dancing away from the sprawling mass of plants. What I first thought was the clearing's edge is actually vine-covered walls, walls that shrink before my eyes. We're rising to the top of this tube. I suddenly feel lighter. We're slowing. With a harsh clank of steel and a tooth-rattling shudder, the landing pad stops. I stand on wobbly legs. The landing pad's edge is still circular, but now it is ringed by a pile of vines 3 times taller than I am. The sun beats down on us, lights up what looks like pointy yellow hills rising all around. Not hills, but rather shapes. I almost know what they are. Or rather, Matilda knew what those are. Then Bishop is beside me.
Em, come on! You've got to see this!
He takes me by the hand, pulls me so hard my head flops back. I stumble along behind him, still clutching my spear. In seconds, we reach the vine ring. At the top stand Farrar and Coyote. Bishop scrambles up, pulling me along behind him. My feet sink into the thick plants, but find enough purchase to let me ascend. I reach the top and look out. This can't be. In all directions, as far as I can see, what I thought were pointy hills are not hills at all. They are buildings, overgrown with thick yellow vines, bluish trees, and other strange plants. Some of the buildings are pyramids, so tall they scrape the sky. We are standing in the middle of a vast, ruined city. 3. I don't know how long the four of us stand atop the vines, staring out. Long enough for Spingate and the other circle stars to join us. The immensity of it all. The sky is like a dome above us, so big I could never reach the edge, even if I walked forever. The buildings, the land, the trees and vines. This place is a million times bigger than the Zolotl, which was the biggest thing I had ever seen. It's so overwhelming. I fight an urge to run back to the shuttle's familiar, confined area. I can tell the others feel the same. Spin, I say. What is this place? I hear her mumbling, speaking quietly to Gaston, back in the shuttle. While I wait, I stare. Tall pyramids block my view in most directions. Where they do not, the city seems to go on and on. The shuttle doesn't know, Spingate says. But Gaston said the shuttle told him to land here, I say. How can it know where to go and not know what the city is? She has no answer. Coyote is on my right. He points toward the horizon. Are those birds? Several somethings fly over the city. Maybe birds, but we're too far from them to make out what they are. There is no sound, save for the breeze sliding past leaves. It sounds like this city is hissing at us. No movement on the streets, Bishop says. Streets. Seems like a strange term for what we see. Wide, straight spaces between the buildings and pyramids. But those spaces are so choked with vines, they look like the flat bottom of steep valleys instead of a place where people might walk. Abandoned, Farrar says. Where are the people who made all this? Coyote turns, looks behind us. The thigh bone slips from his hands, thumps on the vines and rolls down the inner slope. I turn, and am just as stunned. The shuttle lies before us, sitting on its bed of yellow leaves in the middle of the vine ring. Beyond the shuttle, towering buildings block a view of the city. Far beyond those buildings is a pyramid, so massive, the sky itself seems to balance on its point. All the buildings are covered in yellow, but not the tip of this pyramid, which is an orange-brown.
I don't like this, Farrar says. Should we go back to the shuttle?
A loud growl answers him. We all look to Baudin. The sound came from her belly. She shrugs. I'm hungry. So am I. We all are. There is so much to explore here, it might take us a lifetime. Don't rush anything, O'Malley said. We have to carefully think about what we should do next. This place appears abandoned, but I have been alive long enough to know that things are not always as they seem. We return to the shuttle, which gleams beneath the hot sun. I can't believe I once thought the shuttle is large. Nestled in this sprawling city, it is nothing but a toy. We enter to the sound of laughter and excitement. So many happy voices, music to my ears. Everyone is awake, older kids and 12-year-olds alike. Some are alert,
Others are still groggy from the gas. I have Spingate seal the doors behind us. In the coffin room, Gaston and Okariki hold green bins from which they are passing out white food packages. Okariki is a circle, like me, short and thick with muscle. He has the darkest skin of any of us, almost as black as that of the monsters. Bishop takes the bin from Gaston and pats him on the back. Gaston looks to me for the next job. I tilt my head toward the pilot house. You and Spingate get some sleep, I say. We'll all stay here until you're rested. I need your input to figure out what we do next. He grabs a handful of packages from the bin. Then he and Spingate stumble their way to the pilot house and shut the door behind them. I walk toward my coffin. It's not my coffin, not like before, because none of these have our names engraved on them. It's the one I came down in, though, and it seems like the only space in this crowded room that belongs to me. Everyone gives me smiles. They hug me, give my shoulder a squeeze, pat me on the back. They are happy to be alive, excited to explore their new world. I lay my spear down in my coffin's white padded fabric, sit cross-legged on the black floor. So many people in this red-walled coffin room. Not counting Gaston and Spingate, there are 17 of us with full-grown bodies. And then the kids, 108 of them. They are everywhere. Mostly clean shirts and skirts or pants, red ties still on. They are laughing, eating, playing. Sometimes running around madly until someone my age snaps at them to calm down. My age? That's a funny concept. Am I an adult? In body, I suppose. But big or small, we are all 12-year-olds. We are the birthday children. At most, I am a few days older than the smaller kids, not a few years. Bishop strides toward me, a green bin under his big arm. His subtle movements carry him over and around people without jostling a one. He tilts the bin down to me.
The food is good, Em. Grab some.
I reach in, take a handful, read the black letters, protein bar, hard biscuit, and grain bar. All I've ever eaten was fruit and some pig, and not much of either. I tear open the grain bar's wrapper. Inside is what looks like a thin brown brick. I take a bite. The material crumbles between my teeth, and a new flavor explodes across my tongue. I've never tasted this, but I know the right word. It tastes nutty.
Everyone, stop eating!
It's Aramovsky. He's standing on a closed coffin, arms outstretched. All heads turn to look up at him.
We must give thanks for this food, he says. His voice is deep and rich. We must not anger the god who delivered us here.
He is the tallest of us. Standing on the coffin, his head almost reaches the ceiling. He stayed clean for a long time, but now dried blood stands out on his torn white shirt. The damage, both to his dark skin and to the fabric, came when he crashed through a thicket to save me. He stabbed a monster, not knowing it was actually his own progenitor. Our Aramovsky learned that truth just moments before Bishop killed the creature with a broken thigh bone. I think Aramovsky was actually ready to have his mind wiped, maybe even excited to become one with his creator. He wanted it because he thinks that's what his religion dictates. Everyone is watching him, waiting. They have all stopped eating except for one young circle star. She laughs at Aramovsky as she takes a big bite from her bar. He points at her, long arm and long finger stretched out like a different kind of spear.
This god is watching you, girl. Do not anger him.
The laugh drains from the girl's face. She lets the food slip from her hand. It drops to the floor. She's eating and having fun, and he's scaring her? His mysterious invisible gods didn't deliver us here. I did. He makes me so angry. I stand.
You usually talk about the gods, I say. magic beings that don't actually do anything for us. Now it's just one god? Well, which one is it?
I hope that for once, our sparse memories will work in my favor. Forcing him to name something he can't recall will make him look stupid in front of everyone. Maybe shut him up. Aramovsky smiles at me with his big, beautiful, fake smile.
The god of blood, Em.
That sounds ridiculous. I laugh, look around expecting others to be laughing with me. But only a few are. Most stare at him wide-eyed, like he just said something brilliant. I'd hoped he would leave this nonsense up on the Zolotl. Aramovsky is going to be a problem.
No prayers, I say. Everyone, eat.
Aramovsky bows to me.
As you say, great leader.
He steps down and sits. People gather around him. Laughter and talking slowly return. So much hope in this room. Pure joy. The circle stars seem happiest of all. Coyotl and the bigger Visca are wrestling. They strike each other so hard I wince at the sound, but they laugh madly at each impact. Baudin has figured out how to belch on command. Every time she does, circle star kids howl with delight and try to imitate her. Those children are skinny, but they will grow taller, fill out, gain the thick muscle so familiar on the teenage circle stars. Farrar is rooting through every green bin as if he's searching for something very important. He looks up, meets my gaze, then runs to me.
Em, do you have anything sweet?
His hopeful expression makes him look like a child. Wide smile, wide nose, dark eyes, and that big jaw. Farrar is pretty. Everyone here is pretty. I wonder if the grown-ups somehow modified their copies to fit a vision of what they thought they should be, rather than what they are. I shake my head.
I don't think protein bar and hard biscuit sounds sweet.
I offer him the half-eaten grain bar.
Want to try this? It tastes nutty.
He takes a bite, chews, thinks, hands it back to me, then leans in close.
It's just... Well, you're the leader. I thought maybe someone brought you cookies.
He says that word the way Gaston said cloud cover, and Spingate said microorganism.
Sorry. If I had any, I would share them with you.
He snarls, smacks a closed fist against an open palm. I know it's only a gesture of frustration, but it scares me a little. I notice Bishop is still holding his bin, still walking from person to person, offering more food. He stops in front of Aramovsky, who was sitting at the foot of his coffin, and offers the tall boy a package. Aramovsky takes it and sets it on a pile of unopened packages on the floor. His food, and food from others around him. Bishop is making sure everyone has enough, and Aramovsky is hoarding? I think of when I was first walking down the Zolotl's endless hallway with Bello, O'Malley, Spingate, Aramovsky, and Yong. We were starving, talking about the food we dreamed of. Aramovsky wanted cupcakes. I whisper in Farrar's ear.
Maybe there's something sweet in Aramovsky's pile, even if it isn't labeled like that. The people who pack the food could have made a mistake.
Farrar runs down the center aisle toward Aramovsky. Children scramble out of his way. Aramovsky sees the big circle star coming and moves a hand to cover up his collection. That wasn't nice of me, but it's fun to watch them argue about something unimportant, and it makes me happy to give Aramovsky some grief. It shouldn't, but it does. Two little girls run up to me and throw themselves down, somehow landing cross-legged. One is Zubiri, the dark-skinned tooth girl who calmed me when I fought against O'Malley and Bishop, putting me in my coffin. There are no leaves in Zubiri's jet-black hair. No blood, no scratches, no bruises, no scars. Like most of the younger kids, she hasn't suffered that much. The other girl, I don't recognize. She's got hair just as black as Zubiri's, but her skin is light, and her eyes are so thin, I can barely tell they're open. She's also a little chubby. The symbol on her forehead is a circle inside of a circle, a double ring, the same as Aramovsky's.
Hi, Em, Zubiri says.
Hi, Zubiri. Who is your friend?
This is B. Wallazak, Zubiri says. Our cradles were next to each other.
I offer my hand.
Nice to meet you, B. Wallazak.
The girl stares for a second, then giggles and hides her face behind Zubiri's shoulder. Zubiri rolls her eyes dramatically.
Oh, Wallazak, you have to learn how to talk to people.
I've spoken with Zubiri only a few times. Somehow, she seems older than me. Maybe more mature is the right word. That's good, I think. Soon, she will have to do her part. All the kids will. Like a shadow, O'Malley silently sits down beside me.
I was able to access the lower decks, he says. You need to see this.
Farrar and Aramovsky are yelling at each other. Everyone is watching them, laughing at the argument. I quietly follow O'Malley to the back wall and through the stairway door.
Once a door is unlocked, we can leave it that way if we close it, and don't press the handprint or turn the wheel, he says.
We descend past deck 2 to deck 3. As Gaston told me, the door has a wheel with a half-circle symbol on it.
Try and open it, O'Malley says.
The pilot house door has a gear symbol. That door wouldn't open for me, so I doubt this one will either. But I try. The wheel spins easily. The door unlocks.
I thought so, O'Malley says. Locked doors will mostly only open for people who have the matching symbol, but there are a few exceptions. I think you can open some doors because Matilda was in charge of the grown-ups. I'm pretty sure the other empties can't open any door that has a handprint lock.
Empties. That word makes me instantly angry, and I don't know why. O'Malley seems surprised he said it, embarrassed, but I can tell he's just as clueless to its meaning as I am.
Anyway, he says, let me show you what I found.
O'Malley pulls the door open. Inside is a small room with 3 waist-high white pedestals, the same kind that were in that spherical room where I first saw Brewer and Matilda, the place she called the Crystal Ball. I instantly want to knock the pedestals over, smash them. If Matilda's face appears, or Brewer's, I will do just that. We need to leave the grown-ups behind, forever. O'Malley steps to the middle pedestal. Sparkles flare up above it, just like they did in the crystal ball. But instead of Brewer's red-eyed face, I see the words Gambit Priv, and below them, small images, O'Malley's face, and Aramovsky's, and
mine?
I've seen myself only once, a brief reflection in the shuttle's polished hull. That reflection showed dirt and blood, dust and damage, all the bruises I suffered in our fight to escape. Messy hair, split lip, black eye, scratches from my fight in the woods and being dragged through the thicket. The tiny face above the pedestal, though, has no marks, no cuts, no blood. It's me, but older. The last of the girl I am is gone. What I see is all woman, striking and confident. O'Malley's and Aramovsky's images look older, too. So manly. The image makes O'Malley look even more handsome than he already is.
I don't understand, I say. Is that us?
Maybe it's how the grown-ups thought we would look in a few years, or how our progenitors looked when they first designed us, set us to growing in the coffins. It's so strange to look at an older version of myself. Glossy black hair hangs in luxurious curls rather than being pulled back into my severe braid. Smooth, light brown skin. Lips a dark shade of red. Eyelids painted pink. But that face, it's not real. It is the face of a doll, dressed up the way its owner wanted.
You're beautiful, O'Malley says.
The words makes my breath catch. I glance at him. He's not looking at me. He's looking at the image. That isn't me. It's Matilda. How she would look if she wiped me from existence. A picture of me is beautiful, but the real thing isn't. His eyes flick to me, widen.
Whoa. No. That's not what I'm saying.
That's exactly what you said. He shakes his head.
You're beautiful too, Em. When those bruises heal, you look amazing.
But I don't look amazing now. I don't want to talk about it anymore, so I change the subject.
Those words, Gambit Priv, what do they mean?
No idea. When I walked up to the pedestal, this is what appeared. He reaches out and touches the image of my face. Next to it appear two symbols in gold. Circle star, circle cross. Two symbols in silver. The gear and the half circle. And one symbol in white. The double ring. There are no plain circle symbols at all. No empties.
I think gold means you can access any door with those symbols, O'Malley says. Silver might mean you can access some doors with that symbol.
And white means I can't access those areas at all?
He nods.
I think so. I touch the floating picture of O'Malley's face. The symbols and colors are the same as mine, except for the gear, which for him is white. He can't access anything with a double ring or a gear. Then I touch Aramovsky's face. Gold for the double ring. White for everything else.
Why just our three faces? No image of Spingate or Gaston.
The shuttle will fly for Gaston, but has areas he can't access?
Why?
When grown-up Aramovsky died, he was with Matilda. Did they have some connection? And what about grown-up O'Malley? Is that monster still alive too? The grown-ups kept things from each other. They fought. They murdered. They kept themselves divided. I don't want to be anything like them.
Can't we change this, so everyone has access to everything?
I tried, O'Malley says. It won't let me do much of anything. He faces the pedestals, licks his lips. He's acting so strange. What has him so anxious?
Shuttle, where are we?
He asks. A soft voice purrs from the walls.
Omeokan.
Black spots form above all three pedestals. The spots fuzz with sparkles of every possible color, then solidify. I'm looking at a planet. Blue, green, and brown. It spins slowly. It is exactly what I saw up on the Zolotl.
Shuttle, he says. I need to change access privileges.
Chancellor O'Malley Kevin Patrick, speak the access code to continue.
His first name is Kevin? I like that name. But I like O'Malley more.
I think some info is available to anyone, O'Malley says. But most of the questions I ask, it wants a code that I don't know.
The shuttle obviously recognizes him. It must think he is the grown-up O'Malley, after an overwrite. Maybe it will make the same mistake with me. On the Zolotl, Matilda seemed to be in charge. I face the pedestals.
Shuttle, do you know who I am?
Savage Matilda Jean Empress.
Empress? O'Malley laughs. He rolls his eyes, smiling.
Your Highness, should I bow?
I punch his shoulder.
Shuttle,
I say.
What do our symbols mean?
Speak the access code to continue.
If I'm the Empress, I don't need a code. What do our symbols mean? What is this city?
Gambit level information requires verbal confirmation of access code, Empress. Speak the access code to continue.
Told you, O'Malley says.
What else is on this deck?
Nothing as far as I can tell. I think the rest of this deck's space has machinery. Maybe to take care of what's below us on deck 4?
His voice wavers when he speaks. He sounds anxious, and perhaps a little afraid. Whatever he's afraid of, it's down there.
All right, I say. Show me.
His lips press into a flat line.
Come on.
I follow him down to the last deck. There is a wheel door, just like the others, but this one has a circle cross in the hub.
I was able to open it, he says, according to the symbols in the pedestal room. I think you can too.
He waits for me to do so. Now I'm a little afraid, as if his anxiety is contagious. I grip the wheel. It spins easily. I pull the door open and step through. I am looking into a long space, undivided by walls or doors. There is nothing here, in fact, save for what lies on the floor. Two long columns of brown coffins, clean and shining, covered in carvings of jaguars, pyramids, and suns.
4.
O'Malley and I return to the top deck. People are playing, talking, even napping inside the white coffins. I catch Bishop's eye, tilt my head toward the pilot house. He nods, picks up his axe, and follows us. Before we reach the pilot house door, the wheel spins. Gaston and Spingate step out. They don't look as rested as I'd hoped, but they look happy, and that's something.
Back inside, I say. I need to talk to you both.
We enter. Bishop starts to swing the door shut behind us, but it stops halfway. Smiling Aramovsky is blocking it with his body.
Are we making plans? He says.
Good. We need to discuss the spiritual needs of the people.
Bishop glances at me, but when he does, skinny Aramovsky slides through the door and into the room. It would have been one thing to say he couldn't come in. It's entirely another to make him leave, which, of course, Aramovsky knows. Bishop shuts the door.
The first time I entered the pilot house, the walls were black. Now it's as if there are no walls at all. It looks like I'm standing in the middle of the clearing that ends in a tall circular wall of piled vines. I see the shapes of the strange buildings beyond, and I seem to float high above yellow vines, even though the pilot house floor feels just as solid as it ever did. Bishop leans the flat of his axe against his hip. He's waiting for me to speak, as are the others.
O'Malley accessed the shuttle's lower levels, I say. Gaston glares at O'Malley. O'Malley is expressionless, as he always seems to be during discussions like these. I don't mention the room with the pedestals. If Aramovsky is going to make everything his business, I don't want him messing around in there. I quickly describe the room we saw on deck 4, making sure my friends understand these are not simple white coffins, but rather the same kind in which we all first awoke. Bishop looks angry. Spingate and Gaston seem shocked. Aramovsky is delighted.
How wonderful, he says. Did you open them?
Bishop huffs.
Of course she didn't. Em wouldn't do something that dangerous without me and the circle stars there.
Dangerous, Aramovsky says.
Ah, I see. Those new coffins might hold grown-ups instead of people like us. Don't worry, Bishop. I have absolute faith in you. If there are grown-ups, I'm sure you'll find a way to kill them all.
Bishop snarls.
I did what I had to do.
You had to murder. Aramovsky's hands close into fists, open, close, into fists.
Is killing the only thing you're good for, Bishop?
Stop it, I snap.
Aramovsky, your progenitor would have overridden you. Don't you get that? Bishop saved you.
I didn't need to be saved. I was made to join with my creator. Now he's dead. His 1,000 years of wisdom and knowledge lost forever.
Aramovsky makes it sound like we're not as important as the people who wanted to erase us.
We have the right to survive, I say. The grown-ups think we're property, shells to be filled up. They are wrong.
I realize I'm yelling. I take a deep breath, try to calm myself. Aramovsky is so infuriating.
We shouldn't open them, O'Malley says, so calmly it makes my yelling seem all the louder.
Aramovsky holds up his hands as if to say, what choice do we have?
We must open them, and quickly. We don't know what dangers we'll face on this planet. There is strength in numbers.
There is hunger in numbers, Spingate says. Our food won't last long as it is, and as far as we know, there could be people in there who look just like us but have already been overwritten, grown-ups in young bodies.
If that's the case, would they accept us? Would they try to take over, marginalize us, because they think they know better how to live, how to run things? Or maybe they would just kill us. We're only receptacles, after all. Empty vessels have no rights.
Gaston nods in agreement.
Spingate is right about our food situation. How many coffins were there?
O'Malley answers, 168. The number frightens me. Once upon a time, I led 5 people. If those coffins open, if the people inside are like us, I could be responsible for almost 300.
That would be more than double our numbers, Gaston says. Our food will be gone in half the time.
Spingate frowns.
The grown-ups sure seem to like multiples of 3, or maybe 12. Were any of those coffins cracked open, like back on the Zolotl?
O'Malley shakes his head.
I didn't see any damage. They all look sealed.
Leave them that way, Bishop says. At least until we find more food. Whoever it is, if they're in the coffins, they aren't eating anything. They aren't a threat.
O'Malley picks at the scab on his cheek.
What if the shuttle decides to wake them up, he says? Or what if someone up on the Zolotl can do it somehow?
Gaston, you've been talking to the shuttle. Ask it about the coffins.
Gaston sighs. Shuttle, what do you know about the coffins on deck 4?
The honey-sweet voice answers from the walls.
I have no information on deck 4, Captain Xander. My knowledge of that part of the ship has been erased.
I figured, Gaston says. This has been erased. That has been erased. If I ask about anything other than flying, the shuttle doesn't know anything. It doesn't even know why it picked this place to land.
Like us, the shuttle has blank areas. There are instant questions of who erased its memories and why, but those things aren't important right now.
We have to find food, I say. We'll eat up what we have very quickly. Finding food is our first objective.
Bishop shakes his head.
First, we need to understand our immediate surroundings, find places from where we could be attacked, and ways to escape if we are. We need to reconnoiter the area, M.
He says that big word, the way Spingate says microorganisms.
Gaston's sleepy face brightens. I can help with that. The shuttle has powerful sensors for flying. I bet it can make us a map.
He whispers something. He tilts his head, listening, and I see a black jewel in his ear, just like Spingate's. He raises his hands. Light bathes his skin, making him glow like a god. The images on the walls around us suddenly flow toward the middle of the pilot house, shrinking rapidly as they go. The contracting vine ring at the center. In a blur of motion, the entire ruined city seems half the size, a quarter, a tenth, a hundredth. Buildings rush in, transforming from immense blocks of stone to tiny toys lined by tiny streets. The pilot house walls are once again black. The city that's spread out in all directions is now a circle, hovering at waist level. Bishop, Aramovsky, Gaston, Spingate, O'Malley, and I stand at the map's edge. A glowing compass, rose, points out north, south, east, and west. The center of the rose is a circle with the same Mictlan symbol that decorated our ties. Streets and avenues are laid out in a grid. The 2 widest streets are perpendicular. Where they would cross each other, they vanish beneath the city's largest building, that towering pyramid I saw when I was standing atop the vine ring. To the northeast,
A river flows into the city. So real I see the water sparkling, moving. The river ends at a tiny waterfall that drops into a wide pool. I notice something about the vine-covered pyramids. They are flat squares, stacked one on top of another, each smaller than the layer below. They look like the ones that were carved into my birth coffin. Ziggurats, I say. The word just pops out. I've remembered something from Matilda's past. The others look at the stepped pyramids, at each other, and nod. They now remember that word, too. Spingate points to